Book 2, Lud, A Heap of Broken Images. Chapter 4, Town and Ka-Tet. 4 days after Eddie had yanked him through the doorway between worlds, minus his original pair of pants and his sneakers, but still in possession of his pack and his life, Jake awoke with something warm and wet nuzzling at his face. If he had come around to such a sensation on any of the 3 previous mornings, he undoubtedly would have wakened his companions with his screams, for he had been feverish and his sleep had been haunted by nightmares of the Plaster Man. In these dreams, his pants did not slide free. The doorkeeper kept its grip, and it tucked him into its unspeakable mouth, where its teeth came down like the bars guarding a castle keep. Jake awoke from these dreams, shuddering and moaning helplessly. The fever had been caused by the spider bite on the back of his neck. When Roland examined it on the second day and found it worse instead of better, he had conferred briefly with Eddie and had then given Jake a pink pill. "You'll want to take 4 of these every day for at least a week," he said. Jake had gazed at it doubtfully. "What is it?" "Chieflet," Roland said, then looked disgustedly at Eddie. "You tell him. I still can't say it." "Keyflex. You can trust it, Jake. It came from a government-approved pharmacy in good old New York. Roland swallowed a bunch of it, and he's as healthy as a horse. Looks a little like one, too, as you can see." Jake was astonished. "How did you get medicine in New York?" "That's a long story," the gunslinger said. "You'll hear all of it in time, but for now, just take the pill." Jake did. The response was both quick and gratifying. The angry red swelling around the bite began to fade in 24 hours, and now the fever was gone as well. The warm thing nuzzled again, and Jake sat up with a jerk, his eyes flying open. The creature, which had been licking his cheek, took 2 hasty steps backward. It was a billy bumbler, but Jake didn't know that. He had never seen one before now. It was skinnier than the ones Roland's party had seen earlier, and its black and gray-striped fur was matted and mangy. There was a clot of old dried blood on one flank. Its gold-ringed black eyes looked at Jake anxiously. Its hindquarters switched hopefully back and forth. Jake relaxed. He supposed there were exceptions to the rule, but he had an idea that something wagging its tail, or trying to, was probably not too dangerous. It was just past first light, probably around 5:30 in the morning. Jake could peg it no closer than that, because his digital Seiko no longer worked, or rather, was working in an extremely eccentric way. When he had first glanced at it after coming through, the Seiko claimed it was 98-71-65. A time which did not, so far as Jake knew, exist. A longer look showed him that the watch was now running backwards. If it had been doing this at a steady rate, he supposed it might still have been of some use, but it wasn't. It would unwind its numbers at what seemed like the right speed for a while. Jake verified this by saying the word Mississippi between each number, and then the readout would either stop entirely for 10 or 20 seconds, making him think the watch had finally given up the ghost, or a bunch of numbers would blur by all at once. He had mentioned this odd behavior to Roland and had shown him the watch, thinking it would amaze him, but Roland examined it closely for only a moment or two before nodding in a dismissive way and telling Jake it was an interesting clock, but as a rule, no timepiece did very good work these days. So the Seiko was useless, but Jake still found himself loath to throw it away, because, he supposed, it was a piece of his old life, and there were only a few of those left. Right now, the Seiko claimed it was 62 minutes past 40 on a Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday in both December and March. The morning was extremely foggy. Beyond a radius of 50 or 60 feet, the world simply disappeared. If this day was like the previous 3, the sun would show up as a faint white circle in another 2 hours or so, and by 9:30 the day would be clear and hot. Jake looked around and saw his traveling companions. He didn't quite dare call them friends, at least not yet, asleep beneath their hide blankets. Roland close by, Eddie and Susanna a larger hump on the far side of the dead campfire. He once more turned his attention to the animal which had awakened him. It looked like a combination raccoon and woodchuck, with a dash of dachshund thrown in for good measure. "How you doing, boy?" he asked softly.
"Oi!"
The Billy Bumbler replied at once, still looking at him anxiously. Its voice was low and deep, almost a bark, the voice of an English footballer with a bad cold in his throat. Jake recoiled, surprised. The Billy Bumbler, startled by the quick movement, took several further steps backward, seemed about to flee, and then held its ground. Its hindquarters wagged back and forth more strenuously than ever, and its gold-black eyes continued to regard Jake nervously. The whiskers on its snout trembled. "This one remembers men," a voice remarked at Jake's shoulder. He looked around and saw Roland squatting just behind him, with his forearms resting on his thighs and his long hands dangling between his knees. He was looking at the animal with a great deal more interest than he had shown in Jake's watch. "What is it?" Jake asked softly. He did not want to startle it away. He was enchanted. "Its eyes are beautiful." "Billy Bumbler," Roland said.
"Umber!"
the creature ejaculated, and retreated another step. "It talks." "Not really. Bumblers just repeat what they hear, or used to. I haven't heard one do it in years. This fellow looks almost starved. Probably came to forage." He was licking my face. "Can I feed it?" "We'll never get rid of it if you do," Roland said, then smiled a little and snapped his fingers. "Hey, Billy!" The creature mimicked the sound of the snapping fingers somehow. It sounded as if it were clucking its tongue against the roof of its mouth.
"Hey!"
it called out in its hoarse voice.
"Hey, Illy!"
Now its ragged hindquarters were positively flagging back and forth. "Go ahead and give it a bite. I knew an old groom once who said a good bumbler is good luck. This looks like a good one." "Yes," Jake agreed. "It does." Once they were tame, and every barony had half a dozen roaming around the castle or manor house, they weren't good for much except amusing the children and keeping the rat population down. They can be quite faithful, or were in the old days, although I never heard of one that would remain as loyal as a good dog. The wild ones are scavengers, not dangerous, but a pain in the ass.
"Ass!"
cried the bumbler. Its anxious eyes continued to flick back and forth between Jake and the gunslinger. Jake reached into his pack, slowly, afraid to startle the creature, and drew out the remains of a gunslinger burrito. He tossed it toward the Billy Bumbler. The Bumbler flinched back and then turned with a small, childlike cry, exposing its furry corkscrew tail. Jake felt sure it would run, but it stopped, looking doubtfully back over its shoulder. "Come on," Jake said. "Eat it, boy." "Oi," the Bumbler muttered, but it didn't move. "Give it time," Roland said. "It'll come, I think." The Bumbler stretched forward, revealing a long and surprisingly graceful neck. Its slender black nose twitched as it sniffed the food. At last it trotted forward, and Jake noticed it was limping a little. The Bumbler sniffed the burrito, then used one paw to separate the chunk of deer meat from the leaf. It carried out this operation with a delicacy that was oddly solemn. Once the meat was clear of the leaf, the Bumbler wolfed it in a single bite, then looked up at Jake.
"Oi!"
it said, and when Jake laughed, it shrank away again.
"That's a skinny one," Eddie said sleepily from behind them.
At the sound of his voice, the Bumbler immediately turned and was gone into the mist.
"You scared it away," Jake accused.
"Geez, I'm sorry," Eddie said. He ran a hand through his sleek, corkscrewed hair. "If I'd known it was one of your close personal friends, Jake, I would have dragged out the goddamn coffee cake." Roland clapped Jake briefly on the shoulder. "It'll be back."
"Are you sure?"
"If something doesn't kill it, yes. We fed it, didn't we?" Before Jake could reply, the sound of the drums began again. This was the third morning they had heard them, and twice the sound had come to them as afternoon slipped down toward evening, a faint, toneless thudding from the direction of the city. The sound was clearer this morning, if no more comprehensible. Jake hated it. It was as if, somewhere out in that thick and featureless blanket of morning mist, the heart of some big animal was beating.
"You still don't have any idea what that is, Roland?" Susanna asked.
She had slipped on her shift, tied back her hair, and was now folding the blankets beneath which she and Eddie had slept.
"No, but I'm sure we'll find out."
"How reassuring," Eddie said sourly. Roland got to his feet. "Come on, let's not waste the day." The fog began to unravel after they had been on the road for an hour or so.
They took turns pushing Susanna's chair, and it jolted unhappily along, for the road was now mined with large, rough cobblestones. By mid-morning, the day was fair, hot, and clear. The city skyline stood out clearly on the southeastern horizon. To Jake, it didn't look much different from the skyline of New York, although he thought these buildings might not be as high. If the place had fallen apart, as most things in Roland's world apparently had, you certainly couldn't tell it from here. Like Eddie, Jake had begun to entertain the unspoken hope that they might find help there, or at least a good hot meal. To their left, 30 or 40 miles away, they could see the broad sweep of the Send River. Birds circled above it in large flocks. Every now and then, one would fold its wings and drop like a stone, probably on a fishing expedition. The road and the river were moving slowly toward one another, although the junction point could not yet be seen. They could see more buildings ahead. Most looked like farms, and all appeared deserted. Some of them had fallen down, but these wrecks seemed to be the work of time rather than violence, furthering Eddie's and Jake's hopes of what they might find in the city, hopes each had kept strictly within himself, lest the other scoff. Small herds of shaggy beasts grazed their way across the plains. They kept well away from the road except to cross, and this they did quickly, at a gallop, like packs of small children, afraid of traffic. They looked like bison to Jake, except he saw several which had two heads. He mentioned this to the gunslinger, and Roland nodded. Muties. Like, under the mountains? Jake heard the fear in his own voice, and knew the gunslinger must also, but he was helpless to keep it out. He remembered that endless nightmare journey on the handcart very well. I think that here the mutant strains are being bred out. The things we found under the mountains were still getting worse. What about up there? Jake pointed toward the city. Will there be mutants there, or... He found it was as close as he could come to voicing his hope. Roland shrugged. I don't know, Jake. I'd tell you if I did. They were passing an empty building, almost surely a farmhouse, that had been partially burnt. But that could have been lightning, Jake thought, and wondered which it was he was trying to do, explain to himself or fool himself. Roland, perhaps reading his mind, put an arm around Jake's shoulders. No use even trying to guess, Jake, he said. Whatever happened here happened long ago. He pointed. That over there was probably a corral. Now it's just a few sticks poking out of the grass. The world has moved on, right? Roland nodded. What about the people? Did they go to the city, do you think? Some may have, Roland said. Some are still around. What? Susanna jerked around to look at him, startled. Roland nodded. We've been watched the last couple of days. There aren't a lot of folk denning in these old buildings, but there are some. There'll be more as we get closer to civilization. He paused. Or what used to be civilization. How do you know they're there? Jake asked. Smelled them. Seen a few gardens hidden behind banks of weeds, grown purposely to hide the crops. And at least one working windmill way back in a grove of trees. Mostly, though, it's just a feeling, like shade on your face instead of sunshine. It'll come to you three in time, I imagine. Do you think they're dangerous? Susanna asked. They were approaching a large, ramshackle building that might once have been a storage shed or an abandoned country market, and she eyed it uneasily, her hand dropping to the butt of the gun she wore on her chest. Will a strange dog bite? The gunslinger countered. What's that mean? Eddie asked. I hate it when you start up with your Zen Buddhist shit, Roland. It means I don't know, Roland said. Who is this man Zen Buddhist? Is he wise, like me? Eddie looked at Roland for a long, long time before deciding the gunslinger was making one of his rare jokes. Get out of here, he said. He saw one corner of Roland's mouth twitch before he turned away. As Eddie started to push Susanna's chair again, something caught his eye. Hey, Jake, he called. I think you made a friend. Jake looked around, and a big grin overspread his face. 40 yards to the rear, the scrawny Billy Bumbler was limping industriously after them, sniffing at the weeds which grew between the crumbling cobbles of the great road. Some hours later, Roland called a halt and told them to be ready. For what? Eddie asked. Roland glanced at him. Anything. It was perhaps 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They were standing at a point where the great road crested a long, rolling drumlin, which ran diagonally across the plain like a wrinkle in the world's biggest bedspread. Below and beyond, the road ran through the first real town they had seen. It looked deserted, but Eddie had not forgotten the conversation that morning. Roland's question, "Will a strange dog bite?" no longer seemed quite so zinny. "Jake?" "What?" Eddie nodded to the butt of the Ruger, which protruded from the waistband of Jake's blue jeans, the extra pair he had tucked into his pack before leaving home. "Do you want me to carry that?" Jake glanced at Roland. The gunslinger only shrugged as if to say, "It's your choice." "Okay." Jake handed it over. He unshouldered his pack, rummaged through it, and brought out the loaded clip. He could remember reaching behind the hanging files in one of his father's desk drawers to get it, but all that seemed to have occurred a long, long time ago. These days, thinking about his life in New York and his career as a student at Piper was like looking into the wrong end of a telescope. Eddie took the clip, examined it, rammed it home, checked the safety, then stuck the Ruger in his own belt. "Listen closely and heed me well," Roland said. "If there are people, they'll likely be old and much more frightened of us than we are of them. The younger folk will be long gone. It's unlikely that those left will have firearms. In fact, ours may be the first guns many of them have ever seen, except maybe for a picture or two in the old books. Make no threatening gestures. And the childhood rule is a good one. Speak only when spoken to." "What about bows and arrows?" Susanna asked. "Yes, they may have those. Spears and clubs as well." "Don't forget rocks," Eddie said bleakly, looking down at the cluster of wooden buildings. The place looked like a ghost town, but who knew for sure? "And if they're hard up for rocks, there's always the cobbles from the road." "Yes, there's always something," Roland agreed, "but we'll start no trouble ourselves. Is that clear?" They nodded. "Maybe it would be easier to detour around," Susanna said. Roland nodded, eyes never leaving the simple geography ahead. Another road crossed the Great Road at the center of the town, making the dilapidated buildings look like a target centered in the telescopic sight of a high-powered rifle. "It would, but we won't. Detouring's a bad habit that's easy to get into. It's always better to go straight on, unless there's a good visible reason not to. I see no reason not to here. And if there are people, well, that might be a good thing. We could do with a little palaver." Susanna reflected that Roland seemed different now, and she didn't think it was simply because the voices in his mind had ceased. This is the way he was when he still had wars to fight and men to lead and his old friends around him, she thought. How he was before the world moved on, and he moved on with it, chasing that man Walter. This is how he was before the big empty turned him inward on himself and made him strange. "They might know what those drum sounds are," Jake suggested. Roland nodded again. "Anything they know, particularly about the city, would come in handy. But there's no need to think ahead too much about people who may not even be there." "Tell you what," Susanna said. "I wouldn't come out if I saw us. 4 people, 3 of them on. We probably look like a gang of those old-time outlaws in your stories, Roland. What do you call them?" "Harriers." His left hand dropped to the sandalwood grip of his remaining revolver, and he pulled it a little way out of the holster. "But no harrier ever born carried one of these, and if there are old-timers in yon village, they'll know it. Let's go." Jake glanced behind them and saw the bumbler lying in the road with his muzzle between his short front paws, watching them closely. "Oi!" Jake called. "Oi!" the bumbler echoed and scrambled to its feet at once. They started down the shallow knoll toward the town, with Oi trotting along behind them. 2 buildings on the outskirts had been burned. The rest of the town appeared dusty but intact. They passed an abandoned livery stable on the left, a building that might have been a market on the right, and then they were in the town proper, such as it was. There were perhaps 12 rickety buildings standing on either side of the road. Alleys ran between some of them. The other road, this one a dirt track, mostly overgrown with plains grass, ran northeast to southwest. Susanna looked at its northeast arm and thought, "Once there were barges on the river, and somewhere down that road there was a landing and probably another shacky little town, mostly saloons and cribs, built up around it. That was the last point of trade before the barges went on down to the city. The wagons came through this place, going to that place, and then back again. How long ago was that? She didn't know, but a long time from the look of this place. Somewhere, a rusty hinge squalled monotonously. Somewhere else, one shutter clapped lonesomely to and fro in the plain's wind. There were hitching rails, most of them broken, in front of the buildings. Once, there had been board sidewalks, but now most of the boards were gone, and grass grew up through the holes where they had been. The signs on the buildings were faded, but some were still readable, written in a bastardized form of English, which was, she supposed, what Roland called the low speech. Food and grain, one said, and she guessed that might mean feed and grain. On a false front next to it, below a crude drawing of a plains buffalo lying in the grass, were the words, rest, eat, drink. Under the sign, bat-winged doors hung crookedly, moving a little in the wind. Is that a saloon? She didn't know exactly why she was whispering, only that she couldn't have spoken in a normal tone of voice. It would have been like playing Clinch Mountain Breakdown on the banjo at a funeral. It was, Roland said. He didn't whisper, but his voice was low-pitched and thoughtful. Jake was walking close by his side, looking around nervously. Behind them, Oi had closed up his distance to 10 yards. He trotted quickly, head swinging from side to side like a pendulum as he examined the buildings. Now Susanna began to feel it, that sensation of being watched. It was exactly as Roland had said it would be, a feeling sunshine had been replaced by shade. There are people, aren't there? She whispered. Roland nodded. Standing on the northeast corner of the crossroads was a building with another sign she recognized. Hostel, it said, and cots. Except for a church with a tilted steeple up ahead, it was the tallest building in town, 3 stories. She glanced up in time to see a white blur, surely a face, draw away from one of the glassless windows. Suddenly she wanted to get out of here. Roland was setting a slow, deliberate pace, however, and she supposed she knew why. Hurrying might give the watchers the impression that they were scared and that they could be taken. All the same, at the crossroads, the intersecting streets widened out, creating a town square which had been overrun by grass and weeds. In the center was an eroded stone marker. Above it, a metal box hung on a sagging length of rusty cable. Roland, with Jake by his side, walked toward the marker. Eddie pushed Susanna's chair after. Grass whispered in its spokes, and the wind tickled a lock of hair against her cheek. Further along the street, the shutter banged and the hinge squealed. She shivered and brushed the hair away. "I wish he'd hurry up," Eddie said in a low voice. "This place gives me the creeps." Susanna nodded. She looked around the square, and again she could almost see how it must have been on market day. The sidewalks thronged with people, a few of them town ladies with their baskets over their arms, most of them wagoners and roughly dressed bargemen. She did not know why she was so sure of the barges and bargemen, but she was. The wagons passing through the town square, the ones on the unpaved road raising choking clouds of yellow dust as the drivers flogged their cart horses, oxen, they were oxen, along. She could see those carts, dusty swatches of canvas tied down over bales of cloth on some, and pyramids of tarred barrels on others. Could see the oxen, double-yoked and straining patiently, flicking their ears at the flies buzzing around their huge heads. Could hear voices and laughter, and the piano in the saloon pounding out a lively tune like Buffalo Gals or Darlin' Katie. "It's as if I lived here in another life," she thought. The gunslinger bent over the inscription on the marker. "Great Road," he read. "Lud, 160 wheels. "Wheels?" Jake asked. "An old form of measurement." "Have you heard of Lud?" Eddie asked. "Perhaps," the gunslinger said, "when I was very small." "It rhymes with crud," Eddie said. "Maybe not such a good sign." Jake was examining the east side of the stone. "River Road. It's written funny, but that's what it says." Eddie looked at the west side of the marker. "It says Jimtown, 40 wheels. Isn't that the birthplace of Wayne Newton, Roland?" Roland looked at him blankly. "Shet my mouth," Eddie said, and rolled his eyes. On the southwest corner of the square was the town's only stone building, a squat, dusty cube with rusty bars on the windows. Combination county jail and courthouse, Susanna thought. She had seen similar ones down south. Add a few slant parking spaces in front, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Something had been daubed across the facade of the building in fading yellow paint. She could read it, and although she couldn't understand it, it made her more anxious than ever to get out of this town. "Pubes die," it said. "Roland." When she had his attention, she pointed at the graffiti. "What does that mean?" He read it, then shook his head. "Don't know." She looked around again. The square now seemed smaller, and the building seemed to be leaning over them. "Can we get out of here?" "Soon." He bent down and pried a small chunk of cobble out of the roadbed. He bounced it thoughtfully in his left hand as he looked up at the metal box which hung over the marker. He cocked his arm, and Susanna realized, an instant too late, what he meant to do. "No, Roland!" she cried, then cringed back at the sound of her own horrified voice. He took no notice of her, but fired the stone upward. His aim was as true as ever, and it struck the box dead center with a hollow, metallic bang. There was a whir of clockwork from within, and a rusty green flag unfolded from a slot in the side. When it locked in place, a bell rang briskly. Written in large black letters on the side of the flag was the word, "Go." "I'll be damned," Eddie said. "It's a Keystone Cops traffic light. If you hit it again, does it say stop?" "We have company," Roland said quietly, and pointed toward the building Susanna thought of as the county courthouse. A man and a woman had emerged from it and were descending the stone steps. "You and the Cupid doll, Roland," Susanna thought. "They're older'n God, the both of them." The man was wearing bib overalls and a huge straw sombrero. The woman walked with one hand clamped on his naked, sunburned shoulder. She wore homespun and a poke bonnet, and as they drew closer to the marker, Susanna saw she was blind, and that the accident which had taken her sight must have been exceedingly horrible. Where her eyes had been, there were now only two shallow sockets filled with scar tissue. She looked both terrified and confused.
"Be they harrier, Si?" she cried in a cracked, quavering voice. "You'll have us killed yet, I'll warrant."
"Shut up, Mercy," he replied. Like the woman, he spoke with a thick accent Susanna could barely understand. "They ain't harriers, not these. There's a pube with them. I told you that. Ain't no harrier ever been traveling with a pube." Blind or not, she tried to pull away from him. He cursed and caught her arm. "Quit it, Mercy. Quit it, I say. You'll fall down and do yourself evil, damn it."
"We mean you no harm," the gunslinger called. He used the high speech, and at the sound of it, the man's eyes lit up with incredulity. The woman turned back, swinging her blind face in their direction.
"A gunslinger!" the man cried. His voice cracked and wavered with excitement.
"For God! I knew it were! I knew!"
He began to run across the square toward them, pulling the woman after. She stumbled along helplessly, and Susanna waited for the inevitable moment when she must fall. But the man fell first, going heavily to his knees, and she sprawled painfully beside him on the cobbles of the great road. Jake felt something furry against his ankle and looked down. Oi was crouched beside him, looking more anxious than ever. Jake reached down and cautiously stroked his head, as much to receive comfort as to give it. Its fur was silky, incredibly soft. For a moment he thought the bumbler was going to run, but it only looked up at him, licked his hand, and then looked back at the two new people. The man was trying to help the woman to her feet and not succeeding very well. Her head craned this way and that in avid confusion. The man named Si had cut his palms on the cobblestones, but he took no notice. He gave up trying to help the woman, swept off his sombrero, and held it over his chest. To Jake, the hat looked as big as a bushel basket.
"We bid ye welcome, gunslinger," he cried. "Welcome indeed. I thought all your kind had perished from the earth, so I did."
"I thank you for your welcome," Roland said in the high speech. He put his hands gently on the blind woman's upper arms. She cringed for a moment, then relaxed and allowed him to help her up. "Put on your hat, old-timer. The sun is hot." He did, then just stood there, looking at Roland with shining eyes. After a moment or two, Jake realized what the shine was. Si was crying.
"A gunslinger! I told you, Mercy! I seen the shooting iron and told you!"
"No harriers?" she asked, as if unable to believe it.
"Are you sure they ain't harriers, Si?"
Roland turned to Eddie, make sure of the safety, and then give her Jake's gun.
Eddie pulled the Ruger from his waistband, checked the safety, and then put it gingerly in the blind woman's hands. She gasped, almost dropped it, then ran her hands over it wonderingly. She turned the empty sockets where her eyes had been up to the man.
"A gun," she whispered. "My sainted hat."
"Aye, some kind," the old man replied dismissively, taking it from her and giving it back to Eddie. "But the gunslinger's got a real one, and there's a woman got another. She's got a brown skin, too, like my da said the people of Garland had."
Oi gave his shrill, whistling bark. Jake turned and saw more people coming up the street, 5 or 6 in all. Like Cy and Mercy, they were all old, and one of them, a woman hobbling over a cane like a witch in a fairy tale, looked positively ancient. As they neared, Jake realized that two of the men were identical twins. Long white hair spilled over the shoulders of their patched homespun shirts. Their skin was as white as fine linen, and their eyes were pink. Albinos, he thought. The crone appeared to be their leader. She hobbled toward Roland's party on her cane, staring at them with gimlet eyes as green as emeralds. Her toothless mouth was tucked deeply into itself. The hem of the old shawl she wore fluttered in the prairie breeze. Her eyes settled upon Roland.
"Hail, gunslinger! Well met!"
She spoke the high speech herself, and like Eddie and Susanna, Jake understood the words perfectly, although he guessed they would have been gibberish to him in his own world.
"Welcome to River Crossing."
The gunslinger had removed his own hat, and now he bowed to her, tapping his throat 3 times rapidly with his diminished right hand.
"Thank'ee, Si, old mother."
She cackled freely at this, and Eddie suddenly realized Roland had at the same time made a joke and paid a compliment. The thought which had already occurred to Susanna now came to him. This is how he was, and this is what he did. Part of it, anyway.
"Gunslinger ye may be, but below your clothes you're but another foolish man," she said, lapsing into the low speech.
Roland bowed again. "Beauty has always made me foolish, mother." This time she positively cawed laughter. Oi shrank against Jake's leg. One of the albino twins rushed forward to catch the ancient as she rocked backward within her dusty, cracked shoes. She caught her balance on her own, however, and made an imperious shooing gesture with one hand. The albino retreated.
"Be ye on a quest, gunslinger?"
Her green eyes gleamed shrewdly at him. The puckered pocket of her mouth worked in and out.
"Aye," Roland said. "We go in search of the Dark Tower."
The others only looked puzzled, but the old woman recoiled and forked the sign of the evil eye. Not at them, Jake realized, but to the southeast, along the path of the beam.
"I'm sorry to hear it," she cried, "for no one who ever went in search of that black dog ever came back. So said my grandfather and his grandfather before him. Not airy one."
"Ka," the gunslinger said patiently, as if this explained everything. And, Jake was coming to realize, to Roland it did.
"Aye," she agreed. "Black dog Ka. Well, well, you'll do as you're called and live along your path and die when it comes to the clearing in the trees. Will ye break bread with us before you push on, gunslinger? You and your band of knights?"
Roland bowed again. "It has been long and long since we have broken bread in company other than our own old mother. We cannot stay long, but yes, we'll eat your food with thanks and pleasure." The old woman turned to the others. She spoke in a cracked and ringing voice, yet it was the words she spoke, and not the tone in which they were spoken, that sent chills racing down Jake's back.
"Behold ye, the return of the white. After evil ways and evil days, the white comes again. Be of good heart and hold up your heads, for ye have lived to see the wheel of Ka begin to turn once more."
The old woman, whose name was Aunt Talitha, led them through the town square and to the church with the leaning spire. It was the Church of the Blood Everlasting, according to the faded board on the Runderiot lawn. Written over the words, in green paint that had faded to a ghost, was another message: "Death to Greys." She led them through the ruined church, hobbling rapidly along the center aisle, past the splintered and overturned pews, down a short flight of stairs, and into a kitchen so different from the ruin above that Susanna blinked in surprise. Here, everything was neat as a pin.
The wooden floor was very old, but it had been faithfully oiled and glowed with its own serene inner light. The black cook stove took up one whole corner. It was immaculate, and the wood stacked in the brick alcove next to it looked both well-chosen and well-seasoned. Their party had been joined by three more senior citizens, two women and a man who limped along on a crutch and a wooden leg. Two of the women went to the cupboards and began to make themselves busy. A third opened the belly of the stove and struck a long sulfur match to the wood already laid neatly within. A fourth opened another door and went down a short set of narrow steps into what looked like a coal pantry. Aunt Talitha, meanwhile, led the rest of them into a spacious entry at the rear of the church building. She waved her cane at two trestle tables which had been stored there under a clean but ragged drop cloth, and the two elderly albinos immediately went over and began to wrestle with one of them. "Come on, Jake," Eddie said. "Let's lend a hand."
"Nope," Aunt Talitha said briskly. "We may be old, but we don't need company to lend a hand. Not yet, youngster."
"Leave them be," Roland said. "Old fools will rupture themselves," Eddie muttered, but he followed the others, leaving the old men to their chosen table. Susanna gasped as Eddie lifted her from her chair and carried her through the back door. This wasn't a lawn, but a show place, with beds of flowers blazing like torches in the soft green grass. She saw some she recognized, marigolds and zinnias and phlox, but many others were strange to her. As she watched, a horsefly landed on a bright blue petal, which at once folded over it and rolled up tight.
"Wow," Eddie said, staring around. "Bush gardens."
Cy said, "This is the one place we keep the way it was in the old days, before the world moved on. And we keep it hidden from those who ride through. Pubes, grays, harriers. They'd burn it if they knew, and kill us for keeping such a place. They hate anything nice, all of them. It's the one thing all those bastards have in common."
The blind woman tugged his arm to shush him.
"No riders these days," the old man with the wooden leg said. "Not for a long time now. They keep closer into the city. Guess they find all they need to keep 'em well right there."
The albino twins struggled out with the table. One of the old women followed them, urging them to hurry up and get the hell out of her way. She held a stoneware pitcher in each hand.
"Sit ye down, gunslinger," Aunt Talitha cried, sweeping her hand at the grass. "Sit ye down all."
Susanna could smell 100 conflicting perfumes. They made her feel dazed and unreal, as if this was a dream she was having. She could hardly believe this strange little pocket of Eden, carefully hidden behind the crumbling facade of the dead town. Another woman came out with a tray of glasses. They were mismatched but spotless, twinkling in the sun like fine crystal. She held the tray out first to Roland, then to Aunt Talitha, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake at the last. As each took a glass, the first woman poured a dark golden liquid into it. Roland leaned over to Jake, who was sitting tailor-fashion near an oval bed of bright green flowers with oi at his side. He murmured, "Drink only enough to be polite, Jake, or we'll be carrying you out of town. This is Graf, strong apple beer." Jake nodded. Talitha held up her glass, and when Roland followed suit, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake did the same.
"What about the others?" Eddie whispered to Roland. "They'll be served after the voluntary. Now be quiet."
"Will ye set us on with a word, gunslinger?" Aunt Talitha asked. The gunslinger got to his feet, his glass upraised in his hand. He lowered his head as if in thought. The few remaining residents of River Crossing watched him respectfully and, Jake thought, a little fearfully. At last, he raised his head again. "Will you drink to the earth and to the days which have passed upon it?" he asked. His voice was hoarse, trembling with emotion. "Will you drink to the fullness which was, and to the friends who have passed on? Will you drink to good company, well met? Will these things set us on, old mother?" She was weeping, Jake saw, but her face broke into a smile of radiant happiness all the same, and for a moment she was almost young. Jake looked at her with wonder and sudden dawning happiness. For the first time since Eddie had hauled him through the door, he felt the shadow of the doorkeeper truly leave his heart.
"Aye, gunslinger," she said. "Fair spoken. They'll set us on by the league, so they shall."
She tilted her glass up and drank it at a draught. When the glass was empty, Roland emptied his own. Eddie and Susanna also drank, although less deeply.
Jake tasted his own drink and was surprised to find he liked it. The brew was not bitter, as he had expected, but both sweet and tart, like cider. He could feel the effects almost at once, however, and he put the glass carefully aside. Oi sniffed at it, then drew back and dropped his muzzle on Jake's ankle. Around them, the little company of old people, the last residents of River Crossing, were applauding. Most, like Aunt Talitha, were weeping openly. And now other glasses, not so fine but wholly serviceable, were passed around. The party began, and a fine party it was on that long summer's afternoon beneath the wide prairie sky. Eddie thought the meal he ate that day was the best he had had since the mythic birthday feasts of his childhood, when his mother had made it her business to serve everything he liked, meatloaf and roasted potatoes and corn on the cob and devil's food cake with vanilla ice cream on the side. The sheer variety of the edibles put before them, especially after the months they had spent eating nothing but lobster meat, deer meat, and the few bitter greens which Roland pronounced safe, undoubtedly had something to do with the pleasure he took in the food. But Eddie didn't think that was the sole answer. He noticed the kid was packing it away by the plateful and feeding a chunk of something to the bumbler crouched at his feet every couple of minutes, and Jake hadn't been here a week yet. There were bowls of stew, chunks of buffalo meat floating in a rich brown gravy loaded with vegetables, platters of fresh biscuits, crocks of sweet white butter, and bowls of leaves that looked like spinach but weren't, exactly. Eddie had never been crazy about greens, but at the first taste of these, some deprived part of him awoke and cried for them. He ate well of everything, but his need for the green stuff approached greed, and he saw Susanna was also helping herself to them again and again. Among the four of them, the travelers emptied three bowls of the leaves. The dinner dishes were swept away by the old women and albino twins. They returned with chunks of cake piled high on two thick white plates and a bowl of whipped cream. The cake gave off a sweetly fragrant smell that made Eddie feel as if he had died and gone to heaven. "Only buffalo cream," Aunt Talitha said dismissively. "No more cows. Last one croaked 30 years ago. Buffalo cream ain't no prize winner, but better than nothing, by Daisy." The cake turned out to be loaded with blueberries. Eddie thought it beat by a country mile any cake he'd ever had. He finished three pieces, leaned back, and belched ringing before he could clap a hand over his mouth. He looked around guiltily. Mercy, the blind woman, cackled.
"I heard that. Someone be thanking the cook, Auntie."
"Aye," Aunt Talitha said, laughing herself.
"So he do."
The two women who had served the food were returning yet again. One carried a steaming jug. The other had a number of thick ceramic cups balanced precariously on her tray. Aunt Talitha was sitting at the head of the table with Roland by her right hand. Now he leaned over and murmured something in her ear. She listened, her smile fading a little, then nodded.
"Si, Bill, Till," she said, "you three stay. We are going to have us a little palaver with this gunslinger and his friends, on account of they mean to move along this very afternoon. The rest of you take your coffee in the kitchen and so cut down the babble. Mind you make your manners before you go."
Bill and Till, the albino twins, remained sitting at the foot of the table. The others formed a line and moved slowly past the travelers. Each of them shook hands with Eddie and Susanna, then kissed Jake on the cheek. The boy accepted this with good grace, but Eddie could see he was both surprised and embarrassed. When they reached Roland, they knelt before him and touched the sandalwood butt of the revolver which jutted from the holster he wore on his left hip. He put his hands on their shoulders and kissed their old brows. Mercy was the last. She flung her arms around Roland's waist and baptized his cheek with a wet, ringing kiss.
"God's bless and keep ye, gunslinger, if only I could see ye." "Mind your manners, Mercy," Aunt Talitha said sharply, but Roland ignored her and bent over the blind woman.
He took her hands gently but firmly in his own and raised them to his face. "See me with these, beauty," he said, and closed his eyes as her fingers, wrinkled and misshapen with arthritis, patted gently over his brow, his cheeks, his lips and chin.
"Aye, gunslinger," she breathed, lifting the sightless sockets of her eyes to his faded blue ones. "I see you very well."
'Tis a good face, but full of sadness and care. I fear for you and yours.
Yet we are well met, are we not? He asked, and planted a gentle kiss on the smooth, worn skin of her forehead.
Aye, so we are. So we are. Thank ye for your kiss, gunslinger. From my heart I thank ye.
Go on, Mercy, Aunt Talitha said in a gentler voice. Get your coffee.
Mercy rose to her feet. The old man with the crutch and peg leg guided her hand to the waistband of his pants. She seized it, and with a final salute to Roland and his band, allowed him to lead her away.
Eddie wiped at his eyes, which were wet. Who blinded her? He asked hoarsely.
Harriers, Aunt Talitha said. Did it with a branding iron, they did. Said it was because she was looking at him pert. 25 years agone, that was. Drink your coffee now, all of you. It's nasty when it's hot, but it ain't nothing but road mud once it's cold.
Eddie lifted the cup to his mouth and sipped it experimentally. He wouldn't have gone so far as to call it road mud, but it wasn't exactly Blue Mountain blend, either. Susanna tasted hers and looked amazed.
Why, this is chicory!
Talitha glanced at her. I know it not. Docky is all I know, and Docky coffee's all we've had since I had the woman's curse, and that curse was lifted from me long, long ago.
How old are you, ma'am? Jake asked suddenly.
Aunt Talitha looked at him, surprised, then cackled.
In truth, lad, I disremember. I recall sitting in this same place and having a party to celebrate my 80, but there were over 50 people setting out on this lawn that day, and Mercy still had her eyes.
Her own eyes dropped to the bumbler lying at Jake's feet. Oi didn't remove his muzzle from Jake's ankle, but he raised his gold-ringed eyes to gaze at her.
A billy bumbler, by Daisy. It's been long and long since I've seen a bumbler in company with people. Seems they have lost the memory of the days when they walked with men.
One of the albino twins bent down to pat Oi. Oi pulled away from him.
Once they used to herd sheep,
Bill, or perhaps it was Till, said to Jake.
Do you know that, youngster?
Jake shook his head.
Do he talk?
The albino asked.
Some did in the old days.
Yes, he does. He looked down at the bumbler, who had returned his head to Jake's ankle as soon as the strange hand left his general area.
Say your name, Oi.
Oi only looked up at him.
Oi,
Jake urged, but Oi was silent. Jake looked at Aunt Talitha and the twins, mildly chagrined.
Well, he does, but I guess he only does it when he wants to.
That boy doesn't look as if he belongs here, Aunt Talitha said to Roland. His clothes are strange, and his eyes are strange as well.
He hasn't been here long. Roland smiled at Jake, and Jake smiled uncertainly back. In a month or two, no one will be able to see his strangeness.
Aye? I wonder, so I do. And where does he come from?
Far from here, the gunslinger said. Very far.
She nodded.
And when will he go back?
Never, Jake said. This is my home now.
God's pity you, then, she said, for the sun is going down on the world. It's going down forever.
At that, Susanna stirred uneasily. One hand went to her belly as if her stomach was upset.
Suze, Eddie asked, you all right?
She tried to smile, but it was a weak effort. Her normal confidence and self-possession seemed to have temporarily deserted her.
Yes, of course. A goose walked over my grave, that's all.
Aunt Talitha gave her a long, assessing look that seemed to make Susanna uncomfortable, and then smiled.
A goose on my grave? Ha! I haven't heard that one in donkey's years.
My dad used to say it all the time. Susanna smiled at Eddie, a stronger smile this time. And anyway, whatever it was is gone now. I'm fine.
What do you know about the city and the lands between here and there? Roland asked, picking up his coffee cup and sipping.
Are the Harriers? And who are these others, these Grays and Pubes?
Aunt Talitha sighed deeply.
Ye'd hear much, gunslinger, and we know but little. One thing I do know is this. The city's an evil place, especially for this youngster. Any youngster. Is there any way you can steer around it as you go your course?
Roland looked up and observed the now familiar shape of the clouds as they flowed along the path of the beam. In this wide plain sky, that shape, like a river in the sky, was impossible to miss.
Perhaps, he said at last, but his voice was oddly reluctant.
I suppose we could skirt around Ludd to the southwest and pick up the beam on the far side.
It's the beam he follows, she said. Aye, I thought so.
Eddie found his own consideration of the city colored by the steadily strengthening hope that when and if they got there, they would find help, abandoned goodies which would aid them in their quest, or maybe even some people who could tell them a little more about the Dark Tower and what they were supposed to do when they got there. The ones called the Greys, for instance, they sounded like the sort of wise old elves he kept imagining. The drums were creepy, true enough, reminding him of 100 low-budget jungle epics mostly watched on TV with Henry by his side and a bowl of popcorn between them, where the fabulous lost cities the explorers had come looking for were in ruins and the natives had degenerated into tribes of bloodthirsty cannibals. But Eddie found it impossible to believe something like that could have happened in a city that looked, at least from a distance, so much like New York. If there were not wise old elves or abandoned goodies, there would surely be books, at least. He had listened to Roland talk about how rare paper was here, but every city Eddie had ever been in was absolutely drowning in books. They might even find some working transportation. The equivalent of a Land Rover would be nice. That was probably just a silly dream, but when you had thousands of miles of unknown territory to cover, a few silly dreams were undoubtedly in order, if only to keep your spirits up. And weren't those things at least possible, damn it? He opened his mouth to say some of these things, but Jake spoke before he could. I don't think we can go around, he said, then blushed a little when they all turned to look at him. Oi shifted at his feet. No, Aunt Talitha said. And why do you think that, pray tell? Do you know about trains? Jake asked. There was a long silence. Bill and Till exchanged an uneasy glance. Aunt Talitha only looked at Jake steadily. Jake did not drop his eyes. I heard of one, she said. Mayhap even saw it. Over there. She pointed in the direction of the Send. Long ago, when I was but a child and the world hadn't moved on, or at least not so far as it has now. Is it Blaine ye speak of, boy? Jake's eyes flashed in surprise and recognition. Yes, Blaine. Roland was studying Jake closely. And how would ye know of Blaine the Mono? Aunt Talitha asked. Mono? Jake looked blank. Aye, so it was called. How would you know of that, old lay? Jake looked helplessly at Roland, then back at Aunt Talitha. I don't know how I know. And that's the truth, Eddie thought suddenly. But it's not all the truth. He knows more than he wants to tell here. And I think he's scared. This is our business, I think. Roland said in a dry, brisk administrator's voice. You must let us work it out for ourselves, old mother. Aye, she agreed quickly. You'll keep your own counsel. Best that such as us not know. What of the city? Roland prompted. What do you know of Ludd? Little now, but what we know, ye shall hear. And she poured herself another cup of coffee. It was the twins, Bill and Till, who actually did most of the talking, one taking up the tale smoothly whenever the other left off. Every now and then Aunt Talitha would add something or correct something, and the twins would wait respectfully until they were sure she was done. Si didn't speak at all, merely sat with his untouched coffee in front of him, plucking at the pieces of straw which bristled up from the wide brim of his sombrero. They knew little indeed, Roland realized quickly, even about the history of their own town. Nor did this surprise him. In these latter days, memories faded rapidly, and all but the most recent past seemed not to exist. But what they did know was disturbing. Roland was not surprised by this, either. In the days of their great-great-grandparents, River Crossing had been much the town Susanna had imagined, a trade stop on the Great Road, modestly prosperous, a place where goods were sometimes sold, but more often exchanged. It had been at least nominally part of River Barony, although even then such things as baronies and estates of land had been passing. There had been buffalo hunters in those days, although the trade had been dying out. The herds were small and badly mutated. The meat of these mutant beasts was not poison, but it had been rank and bitter. Yet River Crossing, located between a place they simply called The Landing and the village of Jimtown, had been a place of some note. It was on the Great Road, and only 6 days' travel from the city by land and 3 by barge.
Unless the river were low, one of the twins said. Then it took longer, and my granda said there was times when there was barges grounded all the way upriver to Tom's Neck.
The old people knew nothing of the city's original residence, of course, or the technologies they had used to build the towers and turrets. These were the great old ones, and their history had been lost in the furthest reaches of the past, even when Aunt Talitha's great-great-grandfather had been a boy.
The buildings are still standing, Eddie said. I wonder if the machines the great golden oldies used to build them still run.
Mayhap, one of the twins said. If so, young fella, there don't be any man or woman that lives there now who'd still know how to run 'em. Or so I believe, so I do.
Nay, his brother said argumentatively. I doubt the old ways are entirely lost to the grays and pubes even now.
He looked at Eddie.
Our da said there was once electric candles in the city. There are those who say they mout still burn.
Imagine that, Eddie replied wonderingly, and Susanna pinched his leg hard under the table.
Yes,
the other twin said. He spoke seriously, unaware of Eddie's sarcasm.
You pushed a button, and they came on, bright, heatless candles with airy wicks or reservoirs for oil. And I've heard it said that once, in the old days, Quick, the outlaw prince, actually flew up into the sky in a mechanical bird, but one of its wings broke, and he died in a great fall, like Icarus.
Susanna's mouth dropped open. You know the story of Icarus?
Aye, lady, he said, clearly surprised she should find this strange, he of the beeswax wings.
Children's stories, both of them, Aunt Talitha said with a sniff. I know the story of the endless lights is true, for I saw them with my own eyes when I was but a green girl, and they may still glow from time to time. Aye, there are those I trust who say they've seen them on clear nights, although it's been long years since I have myself. But no man ever flew, not even the great old ones.
Nevertheless, there were strange machines in the city, built to do peculiar and sometimes dangerous things. Many of them might still run, but the elderly twins reckoned that none now in the city knew how to start them up, for they hadn't been heard in years.
Maybe that could change, though, Eddie thought, his eyes gleaming. If, that is, an enterprising, travel-minded young man with a little knowledge of strange machinery and endless lights came along. It could be just a matter of finding the on switches. I mean, it really could be that simple. Or maybe they just blew a bunch of fuses. Think of that, friends and neighbors. Just replace half a dozen 400-amp buses and light the whole place up like a Reno Saturday night.
Susanna elbowed him and asked in a low voice what was so funny.
Eddie shook his head and put a finger to his lips, earning an irritated look from the love of his life.
The albinos, meanwhile, were continuing their story, handing its thread back and forth with the unconscious ease which probably nothing but a lifetime twinship can provide. 4 or 5 generations ago, they said, the city had still been quite heavily populated and reasonably civilized, although the residents drove wagons and buckboards along the wide boulevards the great old ones had constructed for their fabulous horseless vehicles. The city dwellers were artisans and what the twins called manufactories, and trade both on the river and over it had been brisk.
Over it? Roland asked. The bridge over the Seine still stands, Aunt Talitha said, or did 20 years ago.
Aye, old Bill Muffin and his boy saw it not 10 years agone, Si agreed, making his first contribution to the conversation.
What sort of bridge? The gunslinger asked.
A great thing of steel cables, one of the twins said. It stands in the sky like the web of some great spider. He added shyly, I shall like to see it again before I die.
Probably fallen in by now, Aunt Talitha said dismissively, and good riddance. Devil's work.
She turned to the twins. Tell them what's happened since and why the city's so dangerous now, apart from any haunts that may den there, that is, and I'll warrant there's a power of them. These folks want to get on, and the sun's on the wester.
The rest of the story was but another version of a tale Roland of Gilead had heard many times and had in some measure lived through himself.
It was fragmentary and incomplete, undoubtedly shot through with myth and misinformation, its linear progress distorted by the odd changes, both temporal and directional, which were now taking place in the world, and it could be summed up in a single compound sentence. Once there was a world we knew, but that world has moved on. These old people of River Crossing knew of Gilead no more than Roland knew of the River Barony, and the name of John Farson, the man who had brought ruin and anarchy on Roland's land, meant nothing to them. But all stories of the old world's passing were similar. Too similar, Roland thought, to be coincidence. A great civil war, perhaps in Garland, perhaps in a more distant land called Porla, had erupted 300, perhaps even 400 years ago. Its ripples had spread slowly outward, pushing anarchy and dissension ahead of them. Few, if any, kingdoms had been able to stand against those slow waves, and anarchy had come to this part of the world as surely as night follows sunset. At one time, whole armies had been on the roads, sometimes in advance, sometimes in retreat, always confused and without long-term goals. As time passed, they crumbled into smaller groups, and these degenerated into roving bands of harriers. Trade faltered, then broke down entirely. Travel went from a matter of inconvenience to one of danger. In the end, it became almost impossible. Communication with the city thinned steadily and had all but ceased 120 years ago. Like 100 other towns, Roland had ridden through, first with Cuthbert and the other gunslingers cast out of Gilead, then alone in pursuit of the man in black. River Crossing had been cut off and thrown on its own resources. At this point, Cy roused himself, and his voice captured the travelers at once. He spoke in the hoarse, cadenced tones of a lifelong teller of tales, one of those divine fools born to merge memory and mendacity into dreams as airily gorgeous as cobwebs strung with drops of dew. "We last sent tribute to the Barony Castle in the time of my great-granda," he said. 26 men went with a wagon of hides. There was no hard coin anymore by then, of course, and 'twas the best they could do. It was a long and dangerous journey of almost 80 wheels, and 6 died on the way. Half fell to harriers bound for the war in the city. The other half died either of disease or devil grass. When they finally arrived, they found the castle deserted but for the rooks and blackbirds. The walls had been broken. Weeds o'ergrew the court estate. There had been a great slaughter on the fields to the west. It were white with bones and red with rusty armor, so my da's granda said, and the voices of demons cried out like the east wind from the jawbones of those who'd fallen there. The village beyond the castle had been burned to the ground, and 1,000 or more skulls were posted along the walls of the keep. Our folk left their bounty of hides without the shattered barbican gate, for none would venture inside that place of ghosts and moaning voices, and began the homeward journey again. 10 more fell on that journey, so that of the 26 who left, only 10 returned, my great-granda one of them. But he picked up a ringworm on his neck and bosom that never left until the day he died. It were the radiation sickness, or so they said. After that, gunslinger, none left the town. We were on our own. They grew used to the depredations of the harriers, Cy continued in his cracked but melodious voice. Watches were posted. When bands of riders were seen approaching, almost always moving southeast along the great road in the path of the beam, going to the war which raged endlessly in Ludd, the townspeople hid in a large shelter they had dug beneath the church. Casual damages to the town were not repaired, lest they make these roving bands curious. Most were beyond curiosity. They only rode through at a gallop, bows or battle axes slung over their shoulders, bound for the killing zones. "What war is that you speak of?" Roland asked. "Yes," Eddie said, "and what about that drumming sound?" The twins again exchanged a quick, almost superstitious glance. "We know not of the god drums," Cy told them. "Airy word or watch? The war of the city now." The war had originally been the harriers and outlaws against a loose confederation of artisans and manufactories who lived in the city. The residents had decided to fight instead of allowing the harriers to loot them, burn their shops, and then turn the survivors out into the big empty, where they would almost certainly die. and for some years they had successfully defended Ludd against the vicious but badly organized groups of raiders which tried to storm across the bridge or invade by boat and barge. The city folk used the old weapons, one of the twins said, and though their numbers were small, the harriers could not stand against such things with their bows and maces and battle axes.
Do you mean the city people used guns? Eddie asked.
One of the albinos nodded. Aye, guns, but not just guns. There were things that hurled the firebangs over a mile or more, explosions like dynamite, only more powerful. The outlaws, who are now the Greys, as you must ken, could do nothing but lay siege beyond the river, and that was what they did.
Ludd became, in effect, the last fortress refuge of the latter world. The brightest and most able traveled there from the surrounding countryside by ones and twos. When it came to intelligence tests, sneaking through the tangled encampments and front lines of the besiegers was the newcomer's final exam. Most came unarmed across the no-man's land of the bridge, and those who made it that far were let through. Some were found wanting and sent packing again, of course, but those who had a trade or a skill, or brains enough to learn one, were allowed to stay. Farming skills were particularly prized. According to the stories, every large park in Ludd had been turned into a vegetable garden. With the countryside cut off, it was grow food in the city or starve amid the glass towers and metal alleys. The great old ones were gone, their machines were a mystery, and the silent wonders which remained were inedible. Little by little, the character of the war began to change. The balance of power had shifted to the besieging Greys, so-called because they were, on average, much older than the city dwellers. Those latter were also growing older, of course. They were still known as pubes, but in most cases their puberty was long behind them, and they eventually either forgot how the old weapons worked or used them up. Probably both, Roland grunted. Some 90 years ago, within the lifetimes of Sai and Aunt Talitha, a final band of outlaws had appeared, one so large that the outriders had gone galloping through river crossing at dawn, and the drogues did not pass until almost sundown. It was the last army these parts had ever seen, and it was led by a warrior prince named David Quick, the same fellow who supposedly later fell to his death from the sky. He had organized the raggle-taggle remnants of the outlaw bands which still hung about the city, killing anyone who showed opposition to his plans. Quick's army of Greys used neither boat nor bridge to attempt entry into the city, but instead built a pontoon bridge 12 miles below it and attacked on the flank. Since then, the war has guttered like a chimney fire, Aunt Talitha finished. We hear reports every now and then from someone who has managed to leave. Aye, so we do. These come a little more often now, for the bridge, they say, is undefended, and I think the fire is almost out. Within the city, the pubes and Greys squabble over the remaining spoils, only I reckon that the descendants of the harriers who followed Quick over the pontoon bridge are the real pubes now, although they are still called Greys. The descendants of the original city dwellers must now be almost as old as we are, although there are still some younkers who go to be among them, drawn by the old stories in the lure of the knowledge which may still remain there. These two sides still keep their old enmity, gunslinger, and both would desire this young man you call Eddie. If the dark-skinned woman is fertile, they would not kill her, even though her legs are short-ended. They would keep her to bear children, for children are fewer now, and although the old sicknesses are passing, some are still born strange. At this, Susanna stirred, seemed about to say something, then only drank the last of her coffee, and settled back into her former listening position. But if they would desire the young man and woman, gunslinger, I think they would lust for the boy. Jake bent and began to stroke Oi's fur again. Roland saw his face and knew what he was thinking. It was the passage under the mountains all over again, just another version of the slow mutants.
You they'd just as soon kill, Aunt Talitha said, for you are a gunslinger, a man out of his own time and place, neither fish nor fowl, and no use to either side. But a boy can be taken, used, schooled to remember some things and to forget all the others. They've forgotten whatever it was they had to fight about in the first place. The world has moved on since then. Now they just fight to the sound of them awful drum beats. Some few still young, most of them old enough for the rocking chair, like us here. All of them stupid grots who live only to kill and kill to live. She paused,
Now that you've heard us old cullies to the end, are you sure it would not be best to go around and leave them to their business?
Before Roland could reply, Jake spoke up in a clear, firm voice.
Tell what you know about Blaine the Mono, he said. Tell about Blaine and Engineer Bob.
Engineer who? Eddie asked, but Jake only went on looking at the old people.
Track lies over yonder, Cy answered at last. He pointed toward the river. One track only, set up high on a column of man-made stone, such as the old ones used to make their streets and walls.
A monorail, Susanna exclaimed. Blaine, the monorail.
Blaine is a pain, Jake muttered.
Roland glanced at him, but said nothing. Does this train run now? Eddie asked Cy.
Cy shook his head slowly. His face was troubled and uneasy. No, young sir. But in my lifetime, and Auntie's, it did. When we were green and the War of the City still went forward briskly, we'd hear it before we saw it, a low humming noise, a sound like you sometimes hear when a bad summer storm's on the way, one that's full of lightning. Aye, Aunt Talitha said. Her face was lost in dreaming. Then it had come. Blaine the Mono, twinkling in the sun, with a nose like one of the bullets in your revolver, gunslinger. Maybe 2 wheels long. I know that sounds like it couldn't be, and maybe it wasn't. We were green, you must remember, and that makes a difference. But I still think it was, for when it came, it seemed to run along the whole horizon. Fast, low, and gone before you could even see it proper. Sometimes, on days when the weather were foul and the air low, it'd shriek like a harpy as it came out of the west. Sometimes it'd come in the night with a long white light spread out before it, and that shriek would wake all of us. It were like the trumpet they say will raise the dead from their graves at the end of the world. So it was.
Tell him about the bang, Cy, Bill or Till said in a voice which trembled with awe. Tell him about the godless bang what always came after.
I was just getting to that, Cy answered with a touch of annoyance. After it passed, there would be quiet for a few seconds, sometimes as long as a minute, maybe. And then there'd come an explosion that rattled the boards and knocked cups off the shelves and sometimes even broke the glass in the window panes. But never did anyone see airy flash nor fire. It was like an explosion in the world of spirits.
Eddie tapped Susanna on the shoulder, and when she turned to him, he mouthed 2 words, sonic boom. It was nuts. No train he had ever heard of traveled faster than the speed of sound, but it was also the only thing that made sense. She nodded and turned back to Cy.
It's the only one of the machines, the great old ones made, that I've ever seen running with my own eyes, he said in a soft voice. And if it weren't the devil's work, there'd be no devil. The last time I saw it was the spring I married Mercy, and that must have been 60 years agone. 70, Aunt Talitha said with authority.
And this train went into the city, Roland said, from back the way we came, from the west, from the forest.
Aye, a new voice said unexpectedly. But there was another, one that went out from the city, and mayhap that one still runs.
They turned. Mercy stood by a bed of flowers between the back of the church and the table where they sat. She was walking slowly toward the sound of their voices, with her hands spread out before her. Cy got clumsily to his feet, hurried to her as best he could, and took her hand. She slipped an arm about his waist, and they stood there, looking like the world's oldest wedding couple.
"Auntie told you to take your coffee inside," he said.
"Finished my coffee long ago," Mercy said. "It's a bitter brew, and I hate it. Besides, I wanted to hear the palaver."
She raised a trembling finger and pointed it in Roland's direction.
"I wanted to hear his voice. It's fair and light, so it is."
"I cry your pardon, Auntie," Cy said, looking at the ancient woman a little fearfully. "She was never one to mind, and the years have made her no better."
Aunt Talitha glanced at Roland. He nodded almost imperceptibly.
"Let her come forward and join us," she said.
Cy led her over to the table, scolding all the while. Mercy only looked over his shoulder with her sightless eyes, her mouth set in an intractable line. When Cy had gotten her seated, Aunt Talitha leaned forward on her forearms and said,
"Now,
Do you have something to say, old Sister Sai, or were you just beating your gums?
I hear what I hear. My ears are as sharp as they ever were, Talitha. Sharper.
Roland's hand dropped to his belt for a moment. When he brought it back to the table, he was holding a cartridge in his fingers. He tossed it to Susanna, who caught it.
Do you, Sai? He asked.
Well enough, she said, turning in his direction, to know that you just threw something to your woman, I think, the one with the brown skin, something small. What was it, gunslinger, a biscuit?
Close enough, he said, smiling.
You hear as well as you say. Now, tell us what you meant.
There is another mono, she said, unless 'tis the same one running a different course. Either way, a different course was run by some mono until 7 or 8 year ago, anyways. I used to hear it leaving the city and going out into the wastelands beyond.
Dung heap, one of the albino twins ejaculated. Nothing goes to the wastelands. Nothing can live there.
She turned her face to him.
Is a train alive till Tudbury? She asked. Does a machine fall sick with sores and puking?
Well, Eddie thought of saying, there was this bear.
He thought it over a little more and decided it might be better to keep his silence.
We would have heard it, the other twin was insisting hotly. A noise like the one Sai always tells of.
This one didn't make no bang, she admitted, but I heard that other sound, that humming noise, like the one you hear sometimes after lightning is struck somewhere close. When the wind was strong, blowing out from the city, I heard it.
She thrust out her chin and added,
I did hear the bang once, too, from far, far out. The night Big Charlie wind came and almost blew the steeple off the church. Must have been 200 wheels from here, maybe 250.
Bulldink, the twin cried. You've been chewing the weed.
I'll chew on you, Bill Tudbury, if you don't shut up your honkin'. You no business saying bulldink to a lady, either. Why,
stop it, Mercy, Sai hissed.
But Eddie was barely listening to this exchange of rural pleasantries.
What the blind woman had said made sense to him. Of course there would be no sonic boom. Not from a train which started its run in Ludd.
He couldn't remember exactly what the speed of sound was, but he thought it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 650 miles an hour. A train starting from a dead stop would take some time getting up to that speed, and by the time it reached it, it would be out of earshot, unless the listening conditions happened to be just right, as Mercy claimed they had been on the night when the Big Charlie wind, whatever that was, had come. And there were possibilities here. Blaine the Mono was no Land Rover, but maybe.
You haven't heard the sound of this other train for 7 or 8 years, Sai? Roland asked. Are you sure it wasn't much longer?
Couldn't have been, she said. For the last time was the year old Bill Muffin took blood sick. Poor Bill.
That's almost 10 year agone, Aunt Talitha said, and her voice was queerly gentle.
Why did you never say you heard such a thing? Sai asked. He looked at the gunslinger. You can't believe everything she says, Lord. Always longing to be in the middle of the stage is my Mercy.
Why, you old slumgullion, she cried and slapped his arm. I didn't say because I didn't want to o'ertop the story you're so proud of, but now that it matters what I've heard, I'm bound to tell.
I believe you, Sai, Roland said, but are you sure you haven't heard the sounds of the mono since then?
Nay, not since then. I imagine it's finally reached the end of its path.
I wonder, Roland said. Indeed, I wonder very much.
He looked down at the table, brooding, suddenly far away from all of them.
Choo-choo, Jake thought, and shivered.
Half an hour later, they were in the town square again, Susanna in her wheelchair, Jake adjusting the straps of his pack while Oi sat at his heel, watching him attentively. Only the town elders had attended the dinner party in the little Eden behind the Church of the Blood Everlasting, it seemed, because when they returned to the square, another dozen people were waiting. They glanced at Susanna and looked a bit longer at Jake, his youth apparently more interesting to them than her dark skin. But it was clearly Roland they had come to see. Their wondering eyes were full of ancient awe. He's a living remnant of a past they only know from stories, Susanna thought. They look at him the way religious people would look at one of the saints, Peter or Paul or Matthew, if he decided to drop by the Saturday night bean supper and tell them stories of how it was, traipsing around the Sea of Galilee with Jesus the carpenter. The ritual which had ended the meal was now repeated, only this time everyone left in River Crossing participated. They shuffled forward in a line, shaking hands with Eddie and Susanna, kissing Jake on the cheek or forehead, then kneeling in front of Roland for his touch and his blessing. Mercy threw her arms about him and pressed her blind face against his stomach. Roland hugged her back and thanked her for her news.
"Will ye not stay the night with us, gunslinger? Sunset comes on apace, and it's been long since you and yours spent the night beneath a roof, I'll warrant."
"It has been, but it's best we go on. Thank ye, Si."
"Will ye come again if ye may, gunslinger?"
"Yes," Roland said. But Eddie did not need to look into his strange friend's face to know they would never see River Crossing again. "If we can."
"Aye."
She hugged him a final time, then passed on with her hand resting on Si's sunburned shoulder.
"Fare ye well."
Aunt Talitha came last. When she began to kneel, Roland caught her by the shoulders. "No, Si, you shall not do." And before Eddie's amazed eyes, Roland knelt before her in the dust of the town square. "Will you bless me, old mother? Will you bless all of us as we go our course?"
"Aye," she said.
There was no surprise in her voice, no tears in her eyes, but her voice throbbed with deep feeling all the same. "I see your heart is true, gunslinger, and that you hold to the old ways of your kind. Aye, you hold very well. I bless you and yours, and will pray that no harm will come to you. Now take this, if you will." She reached into the bodice of her faded dress and removed a silver cross at the end of a fine-link silver chain. She took it off. Now it was Roland's turn to be surprised. "Are you sure? I did not come to take what belongs to you and yours, old mother." "I'm as sure as I can be. I've worn this day and night for over 100 years, gunslinger. Now you shall wear it, and lay it at the foot of the Dark Tower, and speak the name of Talitha Unwin at the far end of the earth." She slipped the chain over his head. The cross dropped into the open neck of his deerskin shirt as if it belonged there. "Go now. We have broken bread. We have held palaver. We have your blessing, and you have ours. Go your course in safety. Stand and be true." Her voice trembled and broke on the last word. Roland rose to his feet, then bowed and tapped his throat 3 times. "Thank ye, Si." She bowed back but did not speak. Now there were tears coursing down her cheeks. "Ready?" Roland asked. Eddie nodded. He did not trust himself to speak. "All right," Roland said. "Let's go." They walked down what remained of the town's high street, Jake pushing Susanna's wheelchair. As they passed the last building, "Trade and Change," the faded sign read, he looked back. The old people were still gathered about the stone marker, a forlorn cluster of humanity in the middle of this wide, empty plain. Jake raised his hand. Up to this point, he had managed to hold himself in, but when several of the old folks, Si, Bill, and Till among them, raised their own hands in return, Jake burst into tears himself. Eddie put an arm around his shoulders. "Just keep walking, sport," he said in an unsteady voice. "That's the only way to do it."
"They're so old," Jake sobbed. "How can we just leave them like this? It's not right."
"It's Ka," Eddie said, without thinking.
"Is it? Well, Ka sucks.
"Yeah, hard," Eddie agreed, but he kept walking. So did Jake, and he didn't look back again. He was afraid they would still be there, standing in the center of their forgotten town, watching until Roland and his friends were out of view, and he would have been right. They made less than 7 miles before the sky began to darken and sunset colored the western horizon blaze orange. There was a grove of Susanna's eucalyptus trees nearby. Jake and Eddie foraged there for wood.
"I just don't see why we didn't stay," Jake said. The blind lady invited us, and we didn't get very far anyway. I'm still so full, I'm practically wobbling.
Eddie smiled. Me too. And I can tell you something else. Your good friend, Edward Cantor Dean, is looking forward to a long and leisurely squat in this grove of trees first thing tomorrow morning. You wouldn't believe how tired I am of eating deer meat and crapping rabbit turds. If you'd told me a year ago that a good dump would be the high point of my day, I would have laughed in your face.
Is your middle name really Cantor?
Yes, but I'd appreciate it if you didn't spread it around.
I won't. Why didn't we stay, Eddie?
Eddie sighed. Because we would have found out they needed firewood.
Huh?
And after we got the firewood, we would have found out they also needed fresh meat, because they served us the last of what they had. And we'd be real creeps not to replace what we ate, right? Especially when we're packing guns, and the best they can probably do is a bunch of bows and arrows 50 or 100 years old. So we would have gone hunting for them. By then it would be night again, and when we got up the next day, Susanna would be saying we ought to at least make a few repairs before we moved on. Oh, not to the front of the town, they'd be dangerous, but maybe in the hotel or wherever it is they live. Only a few days, and what's a few days, right?
Roland materialized out of the gloom. He moved as quietly as ever, but he looked tired and a bit preoccupied.
I thought maybe you two fell in a quick pit, he said.
Nope, I've just been telling Jake the facts as I see them.
So what would have been wrong with that? Jake asked. This dark tower thingy has been wherever it is for a long time, right? It's not going anywhere, is it?
A few days, then a few more, then a few more.
Eddie looked at the branch he had just picked up and threw it aside disgustedly. I'm starting to sound just like him, he thought. And yet he knew that he was only speaking the truth. Maybe we'd see that their spring is getting silted up, and it wouldn't be polite to go until we dug it out for them. But why stop there, when we could take another couple of weeks and build a jackleg water wheel, right? They're old and have no more business hauling spring water than they do hunting buffalo on foot.
He glanced at Roland, and his voice was tinged with reproach. I'll tell you what, when I think of Bill and Till there stalking a herd of wild buffalo, I get the shivers.
They've been doing it a long time, Roland said, and I imagine they could show us a thing or two. They'll manage. Meantime, let's get that wood. It's going to be a chilly night.
But Jake wasn't done with it yet. He was looking closely, almost sternly, at Eddie.
You're saying we could never do enough for them, aren't you?
Eddie stuck out his lower lip and blew hair off his forehead.
Not exactly. I'm saying it would never be any easier to leave than it was today. Harder, maybe, but no easier.
It still doesn't seem right.
They reached the place that would become, once the fire was lit, just another campsite on the road to the dark tower. Susanna had eased herself out of her chair and was lying on her back with her hands behind her head, looking up at the stars. Now she sat up and began to arrange the wood in the way Roland had shown her months ago.
Right is what this is all about, Roland said. But if you look too long at the small rights, Jake, the ones that lie close at hand, it's easy to lose sight of the big ones that stand further off. Things are out of joint, going wrong and getting worse. We see it all around us, but the answers are still ahead. While we were helping the 20 or 30 people left in River Crossing, 20 or 30,000 more might be suffering or dying somewhere else. And if there is any place in the universe where these things can be set right, it's at the Dark Tower.
Why? How? Jake asked. What is this tower, anyway?
Roland squatted beside the fire Susanna had built, produced his flint and steel, and began to flash sparks into the kindling. Soon small flames were growing amid the twigs and dried handfuls of grass.
I can't answer those questions, he said. I wish I could.
That, Eddie thought, was an exceedingly clever reply. Roland had said, I can't answer, but that wasn't the same thing as, I don't know. Far from it. Supper consisted of water and greens. They were all still recovering from the heavy meal they'd eaten in River Crossing. Even Oi refused the scraps Jake offered him after the first one or two.
How come you wouldn't talk back there? Jake scolded the bumbler. You made me look like an idiot.
Idiot,
Oi said, and put his muzzle on Jake's ankle.
He's talking better all the time, Roland remarked. He's even starting to sound like you, Jake.
Ache, Oi agreed, not lifting his muzzle.
Jake was fascinated by the gold rings in Oi's eyes. In the flickering light of the fire, those rings seemed to revolve slowly. But he wouldn't talk to the old people.
Bumblers are choosy about that sort of thing, Roland said. They're odd creatures. If I had to guess, I'd say this one was driven away by its own pack.
Why do you think so?
Roland pointed at Oi's flank. Jake had cleaned off the blood. Oi hadn't enjoyed this, but had stood for it. And the bite was healing, although the bumbler still limped a little.
I'd bet an eagle that's the bite of another bumbler.
But why would his own pack? Maybe they got tired of his chatter, Eddie said.
He had lain down beside Susanna and put an arm about her shoulders.
Maybe they did, Roland said, especially if he was the only one of them who was still trying to talk. The others might have decided he was too bright or too uppity for their taste.
Animals don't know as much about jealousy as people, but they're not ignorant of it either.
The object of this discussion closed his eyes and appeared to go to sleep, but Jake noticed his ears began twitching when the talk resumed.
How bright are they? Jake asked.
Roland shrugged. The old groom I told you about, the one who said a good bumbler is good luck, swore he had one in his youth that could add. He said it told sums, either by scratching on the stable floor or pushing stones together with its muzzle. He grinned. It lit his whole face, chasing away the gloomy shadows which had lain there ever since they'd left River Crossing. Of course, grooms and fishermen are born to lie.
A companionable silence fell among them, and Jake could feel drowsiness stealing over him. He thought he would sleep soon, and that was fine by him. Then the drums began, coming out of the southeast in rhythmic pulses, and he sat back up. They listened without speaking.
That's a rock and roll backbeat, Eddie said suddenly. I know it is. Take away the guitars, and that's what you've got left. In fact, it sounds quite a lot like ZZ Top.
ZZ who? Susanna asked.
Eddie grinned. They didn't exist in your when, he said. I mean, they probably did, but in 63, they would have been just a bunch of kids going to school down in Texas.
He listened. I'll be goddamned if that doesn't sound like the backbeat to something like Sharp-Dressed Man or Velcro Fly.
Velcro Fly, Jake said. That's a stupid name for a song.
Pretty funny, though, Eddie said. You missed it by 10 years or so, sport.
We'd better roll over, Roland said. Morning comes early.
I can't sleep with that shit going on, Eddie said.
He hesitated, then said something which had been on his mind ever since the morning when they had pulled Jake, white-faced and shrieking, through the doorway and into this world.
Don't you think it's about time we exchange stories, Roland? We might find out we know a lot more than we think.
Yes, it's almost time for that, but not in the dark.
Roland rolled onto his side, pulled up a blanket, and appeared to go to sleep.
Jesus, Eddie said, just like that.
He blew a disgusted little whistle between his teeth.
He's right, Susanna said. Come on, Eddie, go to sleep.
He grinned and kissed the tip of her nose.
Yes, Mummy.
5 minutes later, he and Susanna were dead to the world, drums or no drums. Jake found that his own sleepiness had stolen away, however. He lay looking up at the strange stars and listening to that steady, rhythmic throbbing coming out of the darkness. Maybe it was the pubes, boogieing madly to a song called Velcro Fly, while they worked themselves into a sacrificial killing frenzy. He thought of Blaine the Mono, a train so fast it traveled across this huge, haunted world, trailing a sonic boom behind it. And that led him naturally enough to thoughts of Charlie the Choo-Choo, who had been retired to a forgotten siding when the new Burlington Zephyr arrived, rendering him obsolete. He thought of the expression on Charlie's face, the one that was supposed to be cheery and pleasant, but somehow wasn't. He thought about the Midworld Railway Company and the empty lands between St. Louis and Topeka. He thought about how Charlie had been all ready to go when Mr. Martin needed him, and how Charlie could blow his own whistle and feed his own firebox. He wondered again if Engineer Bob had sabotaged the Burlington Zephyr in order to give his beloved Charlie a second chance. At last, and as suddenly as it had begun, the rhythmic drumming stopped, and Jake drifted off to sleep. He dreamed, but not of the Plaster Man. He dreamed instead that he was standing on a stretch of blacktop highway somewhere in the big empty of western Missouri. Oi was with him. Railroad warning signals, white X shapes with red lights in their centers, flanked the road. The lights were flashing and the bells were ringing. Now a humming noise began to rise out of the southeast, getting steadily louder. It sounded like lightning in a bottle. "Here it comes," he told Oi. "Ums," Oi agreed. And suddenly, a vast pink shape, 2 wheels long, was slicing across the plain toward them. It was low and bullet-shaped, and when Jake saw it, a terrible fear filled his heart. The 2 big windows flashing in the sun at the front of the train looked like eyes. "Don't ask it silly questions," Jake told Oi. "It won't play silly games. It's just an awful choo-choo train, and its name is Blaine the Pain." Suddenly, Oi leaped onto the tracks and crouched there with his ears flattened back. His golden eyes were blazing. His teeth were bared in a desperate snarl. "No!" Jake screamed. "No, Oi!" But Oi paid no attention. The pink bullet was bearing down on the tiny defiant shape of the Billy Bumbler now, and that humming sound seemed to be crawling all over Jake's skin, making his nose bleed and shattering the fillings in his teeth. He leaped for Oi. Blaine the Mono, or was it Charlie the Choo-Choo, bore down on them, and he woke up suddenly, shivering, bathed in sweat. The night seemed to be pressing down upon him like a physical weight. He rolled over and felt frantically for Oi. For a terrible moment, he thought the Bumbler was gone, and then his fingers found the silky fur. Oi uttered a squeak and looked at him with sleepy curiosity. "That's all right," Jake whispered in a dry voice. "There's no train. It was just a dream. Go back to sleep, boy." "Oi," the Bumbler agreed, and closed his eyes again. Jake rolled over on his back and lay looking up at the stars. "Blaine is more than a pain," he thought. "It's dangerous. Very dangerous." "Yes, perhaps." "No perhaps about it," his mind insisted frantically. All right. Blaine was a pain, given. But his final essay had had something else to say on the subject of Blaine, hadn't it? "Blaine is the truth. Blaine is the truth. Blaine is the truth." "Oh, geez, what a mess," Jake whispered. He closed his eyes and was asleep again in seconds. This time his sleep was dreamless. Around noon the next day, they reached the top of another drumlin and saw the bridge for the first time. It crossed the Seine at a point where the river narrowed, bent due south, and passed in front of the city. "Holy Jesus," Eddie said softly. "Does that look familiar to you, Suze?" "Yes." "Jake?" "Yes, it looks like the George Washington Bridge." "It sure does," Eddie agreed. "But what's the GWB doing in Missouri?" Jake asked. Eddie looked at him. "Say what, sport?" Jake looked confused. "Midworld, I mean. You know." Eddie was looking at him harder than ever. "How do you know this is Midworld? You weren't with us when we came to that marker." Jake stuffed his hands in his pockets and looked down at his moccasins. "Dreamed it," he said briefly. "You don't think I booked this trip with my dad's travel agent, do you?" Roland touched Eddie's shoulder. "Let it alone for now." Eddie glanced briefly at Roland and nodded. They stood looking at the bridge a little longer. They'd had time to get used to the city skyline, but this was something new. It dreamed in the distance, a faint shape sketched against the blue mid-morning sky. Roland could make out 4 sets of impossibly tall metal towers, 1 set at each end of the bridge and 2 in the middle. Between them, gigantic cables swooped through the air in long arcs. Between these arcs and the base of the bridge were many vertical lines, either more cables or metal beams, he could not tell which. But he also saw gaps and realized after a long time that the bridge was no longer perfectly level. "Yonder bridge is going to be in the river soon, I think," Roland said. "Well, maybe," Eddie said reluctantly, "but it doesn't really look that bad to me." Roland sighed. "Don't hope for too much, Eddie." "What's that supposed to mean?" Eddie heard the touchiness in his voice, but it was too late to do anything about it now. "It means that I want you to believe your eyes, Eddie. That's all. There was a saying when I was growing up, only a fool believes he's dreaming before he wakes up. Do you understand?"
Eddie felt a sarcastic reply on his tongue and banished it after a brief struggle. It was just that Roland had a way, it was unintentional, he was sure, but that didn't make it any easier to deal with, of making him feel like such a kid. "I guess I do," he said at last. "It means the same thing as my mother's favorite saying." "And what was that?" "Hope for the best and expect the worst," Eddie said sourly. Roland's face lightened in a smile. "I think I like your mother's saying better." "But it is still standing," Eddie burst out. "I agree it's not in such fantastic shape. Probably nobody's done a really thorough maintenance check on it for 1,000 years or so, but it is still there. The whole city is. Is it so wrong to hope we might find some things that'll help us there? Or some people that'll feed us and talk to us, like the old folks back in River Crossing, instead of shooting at us? Is it so wrong to hope our luck might be turning?" In the silence which followed, Eddie realized with embarrassment that he had been making a speech. No. There was kindness in Roland's voice, that kindness which always surprised Eddie when it came. It's never wrong to hope. He looked around at Eddie and the others like a man coming out of a deep dream. "We're done traveling for today. It's time we had our own palaver, I think, and it's going to take a while." The gunslinger left the road and walked into the high grass without looking back. After a moment, the other three followed. Until they had met the old people in River Crossing, Susanna had seen Roland strictly in terms of television shows she rarely watched, Cheyenne, The Rifleman, and, of course, the archetype of them all, Gunsmoke. That was one she had sometimes listened to on the radio with her father before it came on TV. She thought of how foreign the idea of radio drama would be to Eddie and Jake and smiled. Roland's was not the only world which had moved on. She could still remember what the narrator said at the beginning of each one of those radio playlets. "It makes a man watchful and a little lonely." Until River Crossing, that had summed Roland up perfectly for her. He was not broad-shouldered, as Marshall Dillon had been, nor anywhere near as tall, and his face seemed to her more that of a tired poet than a Wild West lawman. But she had still seen him as an existential version of that make-believe Kansas peace officer, whose only mission in life, other than an occasional drink in the Long Branch with his friends Doc and Kitty, had been to clean up Dodge. Now she understood that Roland had once been much more than a cop riding a Dali-esque range at the end of the world. He had been a diplomat, a mediator, perhaps even a teacher. Most of all, he had been a soldier of what these people called the white, by which she guessed they meant the civilizing forces that kept people from killing each other enough of the time to allow some sort of progress. In his time, he had been more wandering knight-errant than bounty hunter. And in many ways, this still was his time. The people of River Crossing had certainly thought so. Why else would they have knelt in the dust to receive his blessing? In light of this new perception, Susanna could see how cleverly the gunslinger had managed them since that awful morning in the speaking ring. Each time they had begun a line of conversation which would lead to the comparing of notes, and what could be more natural given the cataclysmic and inexplicable drawing each of them had experienced, Roland had been there, stepping in quickly and turning the conversation into other channels so smoothly that none of them, even she, who had spent almost 4 years up to her neck in the civil rights movement, had noticed what he was doing. Susanna thought she understood why. He had done it in order to give Jake time to heal. But understanding his motives didn't change her own feelings, astonishment, amusement, chagrin, about how neatly he had handled them. She remembered something Andrew, her chauffeur, had said shortly before Roland had drawn her into this world, something about President Kennedy being the last gunslinger of the Western world. She had scoffed then, but now she thought she understood. There was a lot more JFK than Matt Dillon and Roland. She suspected that Roland possessed little of Kennedy's imagination, but when it came to romance, dedication, charisma, and guile, she thought, don't forget guile. She surprised herself by suddenly bursting into laughter. Roland had seated himself cross-legged. Now he turned toward her, raising his eyebrows. Something funny? Very. Tell me something. How many languages can you speak? The gunslinger thought it over. 5, he said at last.
I used to speak the Celian dialects fairly well, but I believe I've forgotten everything but the curses. Susanna laughed again. It was a cheerful, delighted sound. You a fox, Roland, she said. Indeed you are. Jake looked interested. Say a swear in Strelerin, he said. Celian, Roland said. He thought a minute, then said something very fast and greasy. To Eddie it sounded a little as if he were gargling with some very thick liquid. Weak old coffee, say. Roland grinned as he said it. Jake grinned back. What does it mean? Roland put an arm around the boy's shoulders for a moment. That we have a lot of things to talk about. Yeah, I bet, Eddie said. We are Ka-Tet, Roland began, which means a group of people bound together by fate. The philosophers of my land said a Ka-Tet could only be broken by death or treachery. My great teacher, Kort, said that since death and treachery are also spokes on the wheel of Ka, such a binding can never be broken. As the years pass and I see more, I come more and more to Kort's way of looking at it. Each member of a Ka-Tet is like a piece in a puzzle. Taken by itself, each piece is a mystery, but when they are put together, they make a picture, or part of a picture. It may take a great many Ka-Tets to finish one picture. You mustn't be surprised if you discover your lives have been touching in ways you haven't seen until now. For one thing, each of you three is capable of knowing each other's thoughts. What? Eddie cried. It's true. You share your thoughts so naturally that you haven't even been aware it's happening, but it has been. It's easier for me to see, no doubt, because I am not a full member of this Ka-Tet, possibly because I am not from your world, and so cannot take part completely in the thought-sharing ability. But I can send. Susanna, do you remember when we were in the circle? Yes. You told me to let the demon go when you said, but you didn't say that out loud. Eddie, do you remember when we were in the bear's clearing and the mechanical bat came at you? Yes, you told me to get down. He never opened his mouth, Eddie, Susanna said. Yes, you did. You yelled. I heard you, man. I yelled all right, but I did it with my mind. The gunslinger turned to Jake. Do you remember? In the house? When the board I was pulling on wouldn't come up, you told me to pull on the other one. But if you can't read my mind, Roland, how did you know what kind of trouble I was in? I saw. I heard nothing, but I saw. Just a little, as if through a dirty window. His eyes surveyed them. This closeness and sharing of minds is called kef, a word that means many other things in the original tongue of the old world. Water, birth, and life force are only three of them. Be aware of it. For now, that's all I want. Can you be aware of something you don't believe in? Eddie asked. Roland smiled. Just keep an open mind. That I can do. Roland, it was Jake. Do you think Oi might be part of our Ka-Tet? Susanna smiled. Roland didn't. I'm not prepared to even guess right now. But I'll tell you this, Jake. I've been thinking about your furry friend a good deal. Ka does not rule all, and coincidences still happen. But the sudden appearance of a Billy Bumbler that still remembers people doesn't seem completely coincidental to me. He glanced around at them. I'll begin. Eddie will speak next, taking up from the place where I leave off. Then Susanna, Jake, you'll speak last. All right? They nodded. Fine, Roland said. We are Ka-Tet, one from many. Let the palaver begin. The talk went on until sundown, stopping only long enough for them to eat a cold meal. And by the time it was over, Eddie felt as if he had gone 12 hard rounds with Sugar Ray Leonard. He no longer doubted that they had been sharing kef, as Roland put it. He and Jake actually seemed to have been living each other's life in their dreams, as if they were two halves of the same whole. Roland began with what had happened under the mountains, where Jake's first life in this world had ended. He told of his own palaver with the man in black, and Walter's veiled words about a beast and someone he called the ageless stranger. He told of the strange, daunting dream which had come to him, a dream in which the whole universe had been swallowed in a beam of fantastic white light, and how, at the end of that dream, there had been a single blade of purple grass. Eddie glanced sideways at Jake and was stunned by the knowledge, the recognition, in the boy's eyes. Roland had babbled parts of this story to Eddie in his time of delirium, but it was entirely new to Susanna, and she listened with wide eyes. As Roland repeated the things Walter had told him, she caught glints of her own world, like reflections in a smashed mirror. Automobiles, cancer, rockets to the moon, artificial insemination. She had no idea who the beast might be, but she recognized the name of the ageless stranger as a variation upon the name of Merlin, the magician who had supposedly orchestrated the career of King Arthur. Curiouser and curiouser. Roland told of how he had awakened to find Walter long years dead. Time had somehow slipped forward, perhaps 100 years, perhaps 500. Jake listened in fascinated silence as the gunslinger told of reaching the edge of the Western Sea, of how he had lost 2 of the fingers on his right hand, and how he had drawn Eddie and Susanna before encountering Jack Mort, the Dark Third. The gunslinger motioned to Eddie, who took up the tale with the coming of the Great Bear. Shardik? Jake interjected. But that's the name of a book in our world. It was written by the man who wrote that famous book about the rabbits. Richard Adams, Eddie shouted, and the book about the bunnies was Watership Down. I knew that name. But how can that be, Roland? How is it that the people in your world know about things in ours? There are doors, aren't there? Roland responded. Haven't we seen 4 of them already? Do you think they never existed before, or never will again? But all of us have seen the leavings of your world and mine, and when I was in your city of New York, I saw the marks of my world in yours. I saw gunslingers. Most were lax and slow, but they were gunslingers all the same, clearly members of their own ancient quartet. Roland, they were just cops. You ran rings around them. Not the last one. When Jack Mort and I were in the Underground Railway Station, that one almost took me down. Except for blind luck, Mort's flint and steel, he would have done. That one, I saw his eyes. He knew the face of his father. I believe he knew it very well. And then, do you remember the name of Balazar's nightclub? Sure, Eddie said uneasily. The Leaning Tower. But it could have been a coincidence. You yourself said Ka doesn't rule everything. Roland nodded. You really are like Cuthbert. I remember something he said when we were boys. We were planning a midnight lark in the cemetery, but Elaine wouldn't go. He said he was afraid of offending the shades of his fathers and mothers. Cuthbert laughed at him. He said he wouldn't believe in ghosts until he caught one in his teeth. Good for him, Eddie exclaimed. Bravo! Roland smiled. I thought you'd like that. At any rate, let's leave this ghost for now. Go on with your story. Eddie told of the vision which had come to him when Roland threw the jawbone into the fire, the vision of the key and the rose. He told of his dream, and how he had walked through the door of Tom and Jerry's artistic deli, and into the field of roses, which was dominated by the tall, soot-colored tower. He told of the blackness which had issued from its windows, forming a shape in the sky overhead, speaking directly to Jake now, because Jake was listening with hungry concentration and growing wonder. He tried to convey some sense of the exaltation and terror which had permeated the dream and saw from their eyes, Jake's most of all, that he was either doing a better job of that than he could have hoped for, or that they'd had dreams of their own. He told of following Shardik's back trail to the portal of the bear, and how, when he put his head against it, he'd found himself remembering the day he had talked his brother into taking him to Dutch Hill so he could see the mansion. He told about the cup and the needle, and how the pointing needle had become unnecessary once they realized they could see the beam at work in everything it touched, even the birds in the sky. Susanna took up the tale at this point. As she spoke, telling of how Eddie had begun to carve his own version of the key, Jake lay back, laced his hands together behind his head, and watched the clouds run slowly toward the city on their straight southeasterly course. The orderly shape they made showed the presence of the beam as clearly as smoke leaving a chimney shows the direction of the wind. She finished with the story of how they had finally hauled Jake into this world, closing the split track of his and Roland's memories as suddenly and as completely as Eddie had closed the door in the speaking ring. The only fact she left out was really not a fact at all, at least not yet. She'd had no morning sickness, after all, and a single missed period meant nothing by itself. As Roland himself might have said, that was a tale best left for another day. Yet, As she finished, she found herself wishing she could forget what Aunt Talitha had said when Jake told her this was his home now. "God's pity you, then, for the sun is going down on this world. It's going down forever." "And now it's your turn, Jake," Roland said. Jake sat up and looked toward Lud, where the windows of the western towers reflected back the late afternoon light in golden sheets. "It's all crazy," he murmured, "but it almost makes sense, like a dream when you wake up." "Maybe we can help you make sense of it," Susanna said. "Maybe you can. At least you can help me think about the train. I'm tired of trying to make sense of Blaine by myself." He sighed. "You know what Roland went through, living two lives at the same time, so I can skip that part. I'm not sure I could ever explain how it felt anyway, and I don't want to. It was gross. I guess I better start with my final essay, because that's when I finally stopped thinking that the whole thing might just go away." He looked around at them somberly. "That was when I gave up." Jake talked the sun down. He told them everything he could remember, beginning with "my understanding of truth" and ending with the monstrous doorkeeper, which had literally come out of the woodwork to attack him. The other three listened without a single interruption. When he was finished, Roland turned to Eddie, his eyes bright with a mixture of emotions Eddie initially took for wonder. Then he realized he was looking at powerful excitement and deep fear. His mouth went dry, because if Roland was afraid... "Do you still doubt that our worlds overlap each other, Eddie?" He shook his head. "Of course not. I walked down the same street, and I did it in his clothes. But, Jake, can I see that book, Charlie the Choo-Choo?" Jake reached for his pack, but Roland stayed his hand. "Not yet," he said. "Go back to the vacant lot, Jake. Tell that part once more. Try to remember everything." "Maybe you should hypnotize me," Jake said hesitantly. "Like you did before, at the way station." Roland shook his head. "There's no need. What happened to you in that lot was the most important thing ever to happen in your life, Jake. In all our lives. You can remember everything." So Jake went through it again. It was clear to all of them that his experience in the vacant lot where Tom and Jerry's had once stood was the secret heart of the quartet they shared. In Eddie's dream, the artistic deli had still been standing. In Jake's reality, it had been torn down. But in both cases, it was a place of enormous talismanic power. Nor did Roland doubt that the vacant lot with its broken bricks and shattered glass was another version of what Susanna knew as the drawers and the place he had seen at the end of his vision in the place of bones. As he told this part of his story for the second time, speaking very slowly now, Jake found that what the gunslinger had said was true. He could remember everything. His recall improved until he almost seemed to be reliving the experience. He told them of the sign, which said that a building called Turtle Bay Condominiums was slated to stand on the spot where Tom and Jerry's had once stood. He even remembered the little poem which had been spray-painted on the fence and recited it for them. "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth. If you want to run and play, come along the beam today." Susanna murmured, "His thought is slow but always kind. He holds us all within his mind. Isn't that how it went, Roland?" "What?" Jake asked. "How what went?" "A poem I learned as a child," Roland said. "It's another connection, one that really tells us something, although I'm not sure it's anything we need to know. Still, one never knows when a little understanding may come in handy." 12 portals connected by 6 beams," Eddie said. "We started at the bear. We're only going as far as the middle, to the tower. But if we went all the way to the other end, we'd come to the portal of the turtle, wouldn't we?" Roland nodded. "I'm sure we would." "Portal of the turtle," Jake said thoughtfully, rolling the words in his mouth, seeming to taste them. Then he finished by telling them again about the gorgeous voice of the choir, his realization that there were faces and stories and histories everywhere, and his growing belief that he had stumbled on something very like the core of all existence. Last of all, he told them again about finding the key and seeing the rose. In the totality of his recall, Jake began to weep, although he seemed unaware of it. "When it opened," he said, "I saw the middle was the brightest yellow you ever saw in your life. At first, I thought it was pollen, and it only looked bright because everything in that lot looked bright.
Even looking at the old candy wrappers and the beer bottles was like looking at the greatest paintings you ever saw. Only then I realized it was a sun. I know it sounds crazy, but that's what it was. Only it was more than one. It was all suns, Roland murmured. It was everything real. Yes, and it was right. But it was wrong, too. I can't explain how it was wrong, but it was. It was like two heartbeats, one inside of the other, and the one inside had a disease or an infection. And then I fainted. You saw the same thing at the end of your dream, Roland, didn't you? Susanna asked. Her voice was soft with awe. The blade of grass you saw near the end of it. You thought that blade was purple because it was splattered with paint. You don't understand, Jake said. It really was purple. When I was seeing it the way it was purple, like no grass I ever saw before. The paint was just a camouflage, the way the doorkeeper camouflaged itself to look like an old deserted house. The sun had reached the horizon. Roland asked Jake if he would now show them Charlie the Choo-Choo and then read it to them. Jake handed the book around. Both Eddie and Susanna looked at the cover for a long time. I had this book when I was a little kid, Eddie said at last. He spoke in the flat tones of utter surety. Then we moved from Queens to Brooklyn. I wasn't even 4 years old, and I lost it. But I remember the picture on the cover, and I felt the same way you do, Jake. I didn't like it. I didn't trust it. Susanna raised her eyes to look at Eddie. I had it, too. How could I ever forget the little girl with my name? Although, of course, it was my middle name back in those days. And I felt the same way about the train. I didn't like it, and I didn't trust it. She tapped the front of the book with her finger before passing it on to Roland. I thought that smile was a great big fake. Roland gave it only a cursory glance before returning his eyes to Susanna. Did you lose yours, too? Yes. And I'll bet I know when, Eddie said. Susanna nodded. I'll bet you do. It was after that man dropped the brick on my head. I had it when we went north to my Aunt Blue's wedding. I had it on the train. I remember because I kept asking my dad if Charlie the Choo-Choo was pulling us. I didn't want it to be Charlie because we were supposed to go to Elizabeth, New Jersey, and I thought Charlie might take us anywhere. Didn't he end up pulling folks around a toy village or something like that, Jake? An amusement park. Yes, of course it was. There's a picture of him hauling kids around that place at the end, isn't there? They're all smiling and laughing, except I always thought they looked like they were screaming to be let off. Yes, Jake cried. Yes, that's right. That's just right. I thought Charlie might take us to his place, wherever he lived, instead of to my aunt's wedding, and never let us go home again. You can't go home again, Eddie muttered, and ran his hands nervously through his hair. All the time we were on that train, I wouldn't let go of the book. I even remember thinking, if he tries to steal us, I'll rip out his pages until he quits. But of course, we arrived right where we were supposed to, and on time, too. Daddy even took me up front so I could see the engine. It was a diesel, not a steam engine, and I remember that made me happy. Then, after the wedding, that man Mort dropped the brick on me, and I was in a coma for a long time. I never saw Charlie the Choo-Choo after that. Not until now. She hesitated, then added, This could be my copy, for all I know. Or Eddie's. Yeah, and probably is, Eddie said. His face was pale and solemn, and then he grinned like a kid. See the turtle, ain't he keen? All things serve the fucking beam. Roland glanced west. The sun's going down. Read the story before we lose the light, Jake. Jake turned to the first page, showed them the picture of Engineer Bob in Charlie's cab, and began, Bob Brooks was an engineer for the Mid-World Railway Company on the St. Louis to Topeka run. But every now and then, the children hear him singing his old song in his soft, gruff voice, Jake finished. He showed them the last picture, the happy children who might actually have been screaming, and then closed the book. The sun had gone down. The sky was purple. Well, it's not a perfect fit, Eddie said. More like a dream where the water sometimes runs uphill, but it fits well enough to scare me silly. This is Midworld, Charlie's territory. Only his name over here isn't Charlie at all. Over here it's Blaine the Mono. Roland was looking at Jake. What do you think, he asked. Should we go around the city, stay away from this train?
Jake thought it over, head down, hands working distractingly through Oi's thick, silky fur. "I'd like to," he said at last, "but if I've got this stuff about Ka right, I don't think we're supposed to." Roland nodded. "If it's Ka, questions of what we're supposed to or not supposed to do aren't even in it. If we tried to go around, we'd find circumstances forcing us back. In such cases, it's better to give in to the inevitable promptly instead of putting it off. What do you think, Eddie?" Eddie thought as long and as carefully as Jake had done. He didn't want anything to do with a talking train that ran by itself, and whether you called it Charlie the Choo-Choo or Blaine the Mono, everything Jake had told them and read them suggested that it might be a very nasty piece of work. But they had a tremendous distance to cross, and somewhere, at the end of it, was the thing they had come to find. And with that thought, Eddie was amazed to discover he knew exactly what he thought and what he wanted. He raised his head, and for almost the first time since he had come to this world, he fixed Roland's faded blue eyes firmly with his hazel ones. "I want to stand in that field of roses, and I want to see the tower that stands there. I don't know what comes next. Mourners please emit flowers, probably, and for all of us. But I don't care. I want to stand there. I guess I don't care if Blaine's the devil and the train runs through hell itself on the way to the tower. I vote we go." Roland nodded and turned to Susanna. "Well, I didn't have any dreams about the Dark Tower," she said, "so I can't deal with a question on that level. The level of desire, I suppose you'd say. But I've come to believe in Ka, and I'm not so numb that I can't feel it when someone starts rapping on my head with his knuckles and saying, 'That way, idiot.' What about you, Roland? What do you think?" "I think there's been enough talk for one day, and it's time to let it go until tomorrow." "What about Riddledy-Dum?" Jake asked. "Do you want to look at that?" "There'll be time enough for that another day," Roland said. "Let's get some sleep." But the gunslinger lay long awake, and when the rhythmic drumming began again, he got up and walked back to the road. He stood looking toward the bridge and the city. He was every inch the diplomat Susanna had suspected, and he had known the train was the next step on the road they must travel almost from the moment he had heard of it. But he'd felt it would be unwise to say so. Eddie in particular hated to feel pushed. When he sensed that was being done, he simply lowered his head, planted his feet, made his silly jokes, and balked like a mule. This time he wanted what Roland wanted, but he was still apt to say day if Roland said night, and night if Roland said day. It was safer to walk softly, and surer to ask instead of telling. He turned to go back, and his hand dropped to his gun as he saw a dark shape standing on the edge of the road, looking at him. He didn't draw, but it was a near thing. "I wondered if you'd be able to sleep after that little performance," Eddie said. "Guess the answer's no." "I didn't hear you at all, Eddie. You're learning, only this time you almost got a bullet in the gut for your pains." "You didn't hear me because you have a lot on your mind." Eddie joined him, and even by starlight, Roland saw he hadn't fooled Eddie a bit. His respect for Eddie continued to grow. It was Cuthbert Eddie reminded him of, but in many ways he had already surpassed Cuthbert. "If I underestimate him," Roland thought, "I'm apt to come away with a bloody paw. And if I let him down, or do something that looks to him like a double-cross, he'll probably try to kill me." "What's on your mind, Eddie?" "You. Us. I want you to know something. I guess until tonight I just assumed that you knew already. Now I'm not so sure." "Tell me then." He thought again, how like Cuthbert he is. "We're with you because we have to be. That's your goddamn Ka. But we're also with you because we want to be. I know that's true of me and Susanna, and I'm pretty sure it's true of Jake, too. You've got a good brain, me old kefmate, but I think you must keep it in a bomb shelter because it's bitchin' hard to get through sometimes. I want to see it, Roland. Can you dig what I'm telling you? I want to see the tower." He looked closely into Roland's face, apparently did not see what he'd hoped to find there, and raised his hands in exasperation. "What I mean is, I want you to let go of my ears." "Let go of your ears?" "Yeah, because you don't have to drag me anymore. I'm coming of my own accord." "We're coming of our own accord. If you died in your sleep tonight, we'd bury you and then go on. We probably wouldn't last long, but we'd die in the path of the beam. Now do you understand?" "Yes, now I do." "You say you understand me, and I think you do.
But do you believe me as well?
Of course, he thought. Where else do you have to go, Eddie, in this world that's so strange to you? And what else could you do? You'd make a piss-poor farmer.
But that was mean and unfair, and he knew it. Denigrating free will by confusing it with Ka was worse than blasphemy. It was tiresome and stupid.
Yes, he said, I believe you. Upon my soul, I do.
Then stop behaving like we're a bunch of sheep and you're the shepherd walking along behind us, waving a crook to make sure we don't trot our stupid selves off the road and into a quicksand bog. Open your mind to us. If we're going to die in the city or on that train, I want to die knowing I was more than a marker on your game board.
Roland felt anger heat his cheeks, but he had never been much good at self-deception. He wasn't angry because Eddie was wrong, but because Eddie had seen through him.
Roland had watched him come steadily forward, leaving his prison further and further behind. And Susanna, too, for she had also been imprisoned, and yet his heart had never quite accepted the evidence of his senses. His heart apparently wanted to go on seeing them as different, lesser creatures.
Roland drew in deep air.
Gunslinger, I cry your pardon.
Eddie nodded.
We're running into a whole hurricane of trouble here. I feel it, and I'm scared to death. But it's not your trouble. It's our trouble. Okay?
Yes.
How bad do you think it can get in the city?
I don't know. I only know that we have to try and protect Jake, because the old auntie said both sides would want him.
Some of it depends on how long it takes us to find this train. A lot more depends on what happens when we find it. If we had two more in our party, I'd put Jake in a moving box with guns on every side of him. Since we don't, we'll move in column. Me first, Jake pushing Susanna behind, and you on drogue.
How much trouble, Roland? Make a guess.
I can't.
I think you can. You don't know the city, but you know how the people in your world have been behaving since things started to fall apart. How much trouble?
Roland turned toward the steady sound of the drumbeats and thought it over.
Maybe not too much. I'd guess the fighting men who are still there are old and demoralized. It may be that you have the straight of it, and some will even offer to help us on our way, as the river crossing contest did. Mayhap we won't see them at all. They'll see us, see we're packing iron, and just put their heads down and let us go our way. If that fails, I'm hoping they'll scatter like rats if we gun a few.
And if they decide to make a fight of it?
Roland smiled grimly. Then, Eddie, we'll all remember the faces of our fathers.
Eddie's eyes gleamed in the darkness, and Roland was once more reminded forcibly of Cuthbert. Cuthbert, who had once said he would believe in ghosts when he could catch one in his teeth. Cuthbert, with whom he had once scattered breadcrumbs beneath the hangman's gibbet.
Have I answered all your questions?
Nope, but I think you played straight with me this time.
Then good night, Eddie.
Good night. Eddie turned and walked away. Roland watched him go. Now that he was listening, he could hear him, but just barely. He started back himself, then turned toward the darkness where the city of Lud was.
He's what the old woman called a pube. She said both sides would want him.
You won't let me drop this time?
No, not this time. Not ever again.
But he knew something none of the others did. Perhaps, after the talk he'd just had with Eddie, he should tell them. Yet he thought he would keep the knowledge to himself a little while longer. In the old tongue, which had once been his world's lingua franca, most words, like kef and ka, had many meanings. The word char, however, char as in Charlie the Choo-Choo, had only one. Char meant death.